Teach Me to Code, podcast episode number 27. Interview with Jeffrey Grossenbach. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Teach Me to Code podcast. This is your host, Charles Max Wood, and this week we are going to play an interview that I did with Jeffrey Grossenbach. Some of you may know who Jeffrey is if you've watched any of the Peak Code videos or listened to the Ruby on Rails podcast. He's actually a very interesting person to talk to, both about entrepreneurship as well as coding, and we talk a lot about both. But before we get going too far into this, I want to remind you that this podcast is sponsored by New Relic. And New Relic is one of the best monitoring tools that I've used for my applications, and it really helps me pinpoint problem areas and gives me the information I need to make the system work better and helps me track down bugs. So if you're running a Ruby or Java application, I highly recommend you check them out. Beyond that, I just want to remind you that you can leave feedback for the show. You can email me, chuck@teachmetocode.com, or by calling 801-753-8279, and just leave a voicemail, and I'll be happy to play it back on the show and talk about what you have to say. And that's about all I have in the way of announcements, so I'm just going to go ahead and play the interview and just encourage you all to have a great week and write some great code. Hey, everybody. This is Charles Max Wood, and I'm here with Jeffrey Grossenbach. You might have heard of him from Peak Code or Newbie on Rails. He is the senior visionary at the Top Funky Corporation. He's kind of the guy that does it all over there. So, you know, I think senior visionary encompasses everything. Is that about right?
Yeah, I met the guy who was the senior visionary of Lego. So I just kind of took his title and I thought that's something to live up to.
Yeah, I like it. I really like it. There are a few other people in the Ruby community that have interesting titles. I think my other favorite is Jim Wyrix. He's the chief scientist. Right. What is it? The company that he's at.
Edge case. Yeah. Chief scientist. I think Bill Joy was the chief. Well, I mean, all kinds of companies have chief scientists, but Bill Joy was the chief scientist of Sun for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fun. Someday I'll start my own company and then I'll find a cool title like that.
What's good? It starts a conversation too. If you just hand a business card and it just says, you know, employee, then that's kind of the end of it. But if you have an interesting title, then people feel the need to ask you about it.
Yeah, it's true. It's I've heard both business people and non-business people kind of do that, and I've seen companies, especially small startups, where they have that kind of title. Everyone has that title where they made up their own thing and it means something to them. And yeah, it usually gets the conversation started. People start, you know, wondering, well, what does that mean? You still there?
Yes. Yep.
Okay. I do have a few questions. The first thing that I want to ask you about is the Ruby on Rails podcast.
Sure.
I listened to the first couple, and I think they were done by, was it Scott Barron?
Right.
And then you kind of took over from there, and, you know, I'm kind of wondering what happened there, because I don't think it was really well explained. I think you just kind of wound up in charge of the podcast.
Yeah, well, it was kind of unexpected. I heard his first couple podcasts, and I had a little bit of an experience with audio equipment and stuff, and so I thought, well, you know, if I interview somebody, would you take whatever audio I send you and just post that on the podcast? And he said, oh yeah, great, I'd love to. And admittedly, a lot of my early podcasts sounded horrible, both the interviewing and the audio quality as well, but then it just kind of, he never did another one himself, and I did, like 100 more or something like that. So it just kind of faded in. There wasn't an official kind of handing over of the baton. But yeah, Scott's a great guy. Actually, I think he still works for Edge Case also. Speaking of Jim Wyrick working there. So yeah, he he started it. I chipped in and then just kept doing it.
Huh. That's interesting. Because, yeah, I mean, it's only the first couple that I think he's on. And then after that, it's all hosted by you.
Yeah, and a few other people have contributed stuff. I definitely love to just take any contributions to people. Greg Pollock has sent in stuff. So, yeah, it's definitely open if anybody wants to contribute, but I haven't gotten that many submissions so far. Maybe it's easier just start your own podcast like you have and run the whole show yourself.
It could be. It's interesting. It depends on what you want to get out of it, I think. If you want the instant audience, then it makes sense to tap into something that's already established, like the Rails podcast. But if you're trying to build your own business, or you're trying to build your brand or whatever, like I'm doing, where I'm trying to build a brand around Teach Me to Code, and I have plans to go into business for myself and do some coaching and some training and some videos and things like that, then it makes a lot more sense to do it on my own. So
yeah,
that's kind of where I've been heading.
Another thing I appreciate though about a podcast is just the opportunity to just kind of out of the blue, send an email to someone, say, hey, I'd like to have a conversation. And somehow if you have the word podcast in there, somehow they usually will say yes. And then you meet people and get to have an interesting conversation. So I think it's a great way not only to promote yourself, but also to just build relationships and keep that going.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. I mean, I've gotten to know people like Dave Thomas and James Edward Gray and, several other people that I've interviewed, Chad Fowler. And I have learned a lot from those guys. And they're busy guys. I mean, I've only really talked to any of them for an hour, maybe a little bit more. But, I mean, it really has helped me become a better programmer. And it's inspired me to do, to kind of get out there and do different things. And yeah, it's really interesting, not just to, build the brand, but to build the connections. And like you're saying, get to know some people in the community and learn from them and from their experience.
Definitely, yeah.
So then I'm assuming you got into the Rails podcast and then you got into Peep Code. Is that right order? Or?
Yeah, I think I started Peep Code maybe a year later. I was just doing Rails freelancing for actually mostly just one startup about an hour north of San Francisco, although working remotely for my place in Seattle. And I thought, well, hey, could I take one day a week to produce these screencasts? And could that, by charging a little bit, could that help to pay for my time so that I could actually put some serious time into these? And people loved them and it took off. So definitely related, and definitely doing the Rails podcast helped me start that. But chose to make it just a separate thing and build a business out of it.
That makes sense. Now, it looks like you are coming up on 4 years of Peep Code. Is that correct?
Yeah, incredible. I'm kind of shocked that it's been that long. I was calculating the other day, and it's like I've worked for my own businesses more than I've worked for any other businesses, I think maybe even put together. So I feel very fortunate. It's, definitely a lot of stress and, got to come up with new ideas, but a lot of fun and very fulfilling too.
Yeah. And then there's also the famous Newbie on Rails blog that you've done. I'm kind of curious, with all of these different things that you've done, which one is your favorite? The screencast, the podcast, the blog?
Well, I'm going to pull another one out and say that about 6 months ago, I started a different blog, blog.peepcode.com, where for every article, I have a different visual design. And sometimes, like this most recent one, I even commissioned an illustration for the header and right now, I'm really enjoying doing that. The screencasts are definitely interesting, and I've learned all kinds of things about video editing and animation. But as a recent thing, that's definitely been fun. I think I'm going to probably just redirect Newbie on Rails over to that new blog pretty soon, because that's where I'm putting most of my blogging effort.
That makes sense. Now, your latest article on blog.peepcode.com, I can't tell if people are talking more about the fact that it has a unique design for every blog post, or if they're talking more about the content where you're talking about the Rails router and things like that, and maybe a proposal as to things that could change between the way Rails currently does things and the way that Rails could do things with routing and building things into the controller.
Yeah, I get two for one that way. Especially the previous article, I had an orange background, and a lot of people were just offended at orange being used. And I don't know, maybe it was a little too audacious there. But yeah, people talk about the design, they talk about the content, and yeah, it's all good.
Mm-hmm. So are there specific things or specific goals that you have with writing about certain things, or is it more just whatever you're interested in or looking into at the time?
Well, one thing, it's always, you know, when you're trying to build a name for yourself and then build a business, it's hard to know, you know, should I latch on to a specific technology or should I try to build my own brand? And I mean, you're kind of talking about that already. So with Newbie on Rails, I had Rails right there in the title, and I kind of felt like I had to write about Rails related stuff all the time. So with this new one, I'm trying to have a little bit broader scope of topics. Most of them have pretty much been about Ruby or Rails so far, but I'm going to hit a variety of topics there, and I find it a good both creative and just, you know, creative output to have this little paper sketchbook where I write all kinds of ideas of different things I think I'd like to write about. And, you know, occasionally I'll just pick one off there and try to put something together. So
that
Rails,
makes sense.
JavaScript, even just graphic design, other kind, you know, been doing a lot of Mac Ruby desktop development recently. A whole variety of things I think are going to show up there.
Now, do you ever go outside of the topics related to development for things that you're writing about or thinking about? Or,
I try to keep it fairly tech-focused. My very first post was about the design of my business card, so that is not directly technological. I think part of having something, especially even Peep Code, which has nothing about even Ruby or Rails specific in the name, was just have something wide open to where I'd have a open field to where any topic that was interesting I could write on that. But, you know, going completely non-technical, I don't know, it'll probably stay pretty technical.
That makes sense. Now, I did read on the Newbie on Rails, I think the last post on there was the 3-year, which was almost a year ago, actually. And there were a couple of interesting points that I noticed on there. One was that you saw that a few people were having some success with screencasts. And I'm just kind of curious how you go through the process of determining, and this article does go into it some, the process of determining whether or not you want to go into a business. And let me just preface that by pointing out that I've felt for a long time that people who are developers have a skill set that allows them to operate in basically whatever field they want, because any field needs technology. And so if somebody has an idea that can revolutionize some area or field of work that they're interested in, I think that there are a lot of opportunities out there. And so I'm kind of curious what process you go through for determining, okay, this will or won't work, and this is something I want to do, and I can stick with this, and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, good question. I'm going to try to put together a lot of those ideas for a conference I'm going to speak at in a couple months. It's SchnitzelConf, put together by Amy Hoy and Thomas Fuchs. It's actually going to be in Vienna, Austria, all about entrepreneurship and starting businesses and things like that. First, I should say, you know, so far I feel like I have, you know, I don't have many repeat hits as far as starting a whole bunch of businesses. So my knowledge of that is somewhat limited. On the other hand, with Peep Code, I do have to kind of come up with new ideas all the time. You know, I do one screencast and now it's on to the next one. I have to think of what topic to do, you know, get feedback from people, and go for that. Or recently I started selling this desktop app, which is basically just kind of a helper app to help you navigate between the files in your text editor while you're working on a programming project. And so it's going to be pretty stereotypical or standard now that you've heard this a lot, but all those things I think were things that I personally wanted. I still wish there was somebody out there doing high quality screencasts on a variety of topics that I could learn some different things, but at least the way that I want to do things, and to clarify, I'm not saying that nobody's doing screencasts. I'm just saying there are a whole number of technical fields wide open where somebody could get in, you know, pick some of these different languages or technologies and get in there and produce some good stuff. But yeah, so with the screencasts, I think it was just something that I found interesting. I personally thought it, you know, it would be something that I'd be willing to pay for. And from there, it was just experimentation, get a product out there, see if people buy it. For this desktop app, I was semi-surprised, and I guess it's for any entrepreneur. Hopefully you're not too surprised when an idea is successful, because, you know, hopefully you put your effort into things that you think are going to be successful. But just, you know, file navigation has been something that's annoyed me for years. And so I finally just said, okay, let's just sit down and see if I can do something about this. And thanks to Mac Ruby, you know, I was able to pound out a prototype in a couple of days. And then after getting it out there, get some feedback and continue to improve it. And it sold a lot better than I expected. So here's one thing right there: desktop apps. I know a lot of web developers are kind of anti desktop apps for some reason, but you know, if you want to have a product to where you can charge a reasonable amount of money for it, and by that I mean, you know, $9 instead of 99 cents, and also have a big market, to me, write good desktop apps that hook in with web services and present that well. I'd pay for a good desktop app that hooks into New Relic, you know, performance stats for your Rails your Ruby applications, or even things like the GitHub bug tracker. It's a great idea, but I think their implementation as a website, and intentionally, is just very simple and very minimal. If somebody put together a good desktop app that looked beautiful and gave a really good experience, I think you could easily charge $20 or $30 for that, and I'd be your first customer.
That's true, and it's interesting. I think a lot of people think about kind of the endpoint, so they're thinking about things like GitHub or Pivotal Tracker, or, you know, Scout, or New Relic, or, you know, all of these different things, and nobody really thinks about the space in the middle. You know, how do I tie all these things together? You know, and it seems like that's kind of where you're going, is, you know, both in the feature augmentation that you would get from an app that took advantage of, you know, GitHub's functionality, as well as something that kind of tied it together so you could see, okay, well, you know, these are the outstanding bugs, and I can see over here the performance on New Relic, and so I can see it's a problem, and, you know, and then it ties into my, you know, some other system that's related to it that's, you know, keeping track of something else for me, maybe my, you know, my overall burn down or something, and you know, just make that happen.
Exactly, and a lot of desktop app developers aren't thinking about the web. I mean, it's like an amazing thing for them just to you know, sync your preferences to a web database or something like that. But web developers are very familiar with APIs, building a, you know, a JSON or XML API and putting that up there in a website. So, you know, there are all these holes to where people are just kind of staying in their own little areas and not trying to cross over. And in that crossover space, there are all these, I think, good and potentially profitable ideas that people could capitalize on.
Yeah, well, you see that a lot. I mean, even in cross-functional teams, right? I work on a team. We have the front end is Flex and Flash, and the back end is Rails. And up until last week, really, it was last week, we were more or less two teams, front end and back end. And, you know, my boss decided, and I think rightly so, that everybody needed to understand the entire system, and it would solve a lot of the problems that we were having in that crossover space. Because that's where the breakdowns were happening. That's where the bugs would occur, is, you know, one system talking to another and one system not understanding how the other system was sending data back and things like that.
Exactly. And at least for me personally, I love being in that space to where it's like, I'm learning something new. I'm getting a perspective from somebody else that I wouldn't have thought about. And like you said, all kinds of bugs to be discovered there. Another thing, especially with the testing focus of a lot of Ruby developers, is, you know, talking to real full-time QA test people. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily people who write automated tests, but, you know, I remember one of my first jobs out of college, the kinds of bugs that would get filed back by the QA team. Initially, I thought, you know, this is ridiculous. Why are they filing a bug on this? But later I realized, no, these are the people who really know how to work an application right and left and figure out all the edges of it. And sure, some of the things they found may be just completely ad hoc that no one would ever actually try to do on a website. But if you're building an app that can stand up to that intense kind of interaction, then suddenly you have a really powerful app. So trying to understand these other departments of a company or of development and have that at least in the back of your mind, I think is a huge benefit.
Mm-hmm. That's also something that I learned when I worked for Mozy. When I started there, I was in technical support. In fact, I was running technical support. And so I wasn't just the guy talking to the customers, but I was talking to the customers, talking to the people who talked to the customers, and then I was turning around and talking to QA and developers and management and, you know, all of the stakeholders, you know, basically in the product. And after about 2 years, I decided that I wanted to go into development, so I moved over to QA. And it's so interesting to see the different perspectives that people have. And you really do come to understand that. You know, another perspective that I gained while I was there was that my brother, I helped him get a job there, and he was on the sales team. In fact, he was their top salesman. And, you know, so rather than having conversations that were, you know, where we were arguing about points, you know, I was talking to my brother, so we would just talk about stuff and, you know, see his perspective on things and why things bothered him and why things didn't bother him and, you know, what his understanding was of the systems that were behind things. And, you know, it was always interesting to see that everybody has their own view on things and they're all right.
Right. Yeah, I've been reading a graphic design book where this basically it's a book made up of six or eight individual books, and each of those have a different design. So that was kind of, you know, interesting to me with trying to write a blog that way. But one of his phrases in there was, you know, everybody always thinks they're right. And that, you know, if I write a program and I send it off to the Q&A team, I don't expect that they're going to find a single bug because I wrote a great program. But, you know, of mm-hmm. course they do, because no, the program wasn't perfect and I wasn't right. And trying to realize that is, I guess, kind of a step of maturity.
That makes sense. I'm kind of curious, do you find that there are parallels in the creativity behind doing things like design and development and the creativity that goes into things like creating a screencast and things like that?
Oh, definitely. I mean, you got to, I think a commonality between all of them is just we're trying to come up with things that have never been done. It's not that they're impossible, but it's just we're doing new things, whether you're writing a back-end library or a visual layout for how something's going to look, or, you know, motion graphics for a screencast or something like that. I mean, it's just coming up with something new, which I have to say is often pretty tiring. I used to kind of try to drive myself to where almost every waking hour I was doing some kind of educational learning thing. You know, maybe I was reading history in the evenings, or, you know, during the day doing coding and design or whatever. And it's exhausting. It's like, it's almost better to plan some kind of downtime to where your mind just gels and, you know, turns to jello and you're not trying to be creative, solve problems, that kind of thing 100% of the time. And then either your subconscious figures things out or you come back to it and you figure it out once you're focusing on it. So I think that's definitely common across the whole range of software development or web development or whatever.
That's interesting. What do you do to get your brain that kind of downtime?
Well, recently, you know, not trying to sound like an ascetic or something like that, but I think since college, I never owned a television. And so it was always, if I was going to entertain myself, it was usually, you know, reading a book or going out and doing exercise or something like that. And, which I still try to do, but, recently, just in the last 6 months, I finally, went in and bought it, you know, bought a big TV and, especially very excited about the World Cup of Soccer going on right now. Have a British friend who just moved here, close to me in Seattle. So we watched the, US and England game together last Saturday.
That was a great game.
Yeah, definitely
oh
exciting.
My gosh. So, yeah, I won't take the next half hour talking about that. That I've been watching the World Cup myself.
But I guess it's stuff like that, which probably for most people, I mean, that's just standard. Of course, you have a TV. But for me, it was like an intentional thing of, oh, if I have a TV, then it's something that I can just turn on. I just kind of zone out. I enjoy whatever I'm watching, and I don't have to be like actively trying to stuff new information into my brain or solve some problem.
Yeah, it's interesting the approach there. I think it's funny because I've gotten to the point, I listen to podcasts all day at work while I'm working, and, you know, I'm only really half listening, but I'm still picking things up even though I'm focused primarily on coding. But, you know, when I come home and I turn on a TV show or something and just kind of relax, which doesn't happen all that often, but when it does, I almost instinctively find myself reaching for whatever it is that's the closest media for me to be learning something else. And so I have to force myself to stop. That's one thing that's really nice about, I recently took up running and, you know, so that's nice to get out, you know, and I take my iPod with me, but, you know, I've kind of set a rule for myself that I listen to music when I run. So, and I used to listen to podcasts even then, but I listen to the music and, you know, I come back and I'm almost more relaxed because I'm not so focused on obtaining information. I'm just focused on moving my legs and my arms and letting my mind just relax.
Exactly. Well, I'm right there with you with the jogging. I hopefully you enjoy it more than I do. Personally, I hate running, even though I've done it. I won a bunch of track and field races in high school and stuff like that. And then now every year I do this 200-mile relay race in the summer with like 10 people, and it's like 24 hours around the clock. I'm not running for 24 hours, but I think I end up running about 15 miles in three different segments. But every year I say, oh, I'm not going to do this again. But somehow having something out there, it motivates me. And I hate to admit it, but I do feel good after I've done a long run. And, you get some exercise, gets the blood flowing to the brain or whatever. And it's definitely worthwhile.
Yeah, for me, it's still kind of novel, so I really do enjoy the running.
Okay.
I was a swimmer in high school, so for me, it's hard to get in the pool and swim any distance because I realize immediately how bad a shape I'm in and how terrible I am at swimming anymore. And so it's kind of painful that way. But other than that, it's not so bad running. And I'm looking to take up cycling, so we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, cycling's fun. The hard thing about cycling is you need such a long distance. I mean, you got to have, I live right in the city of Seattle, and for the first 10 miles of cycling or something, it's stoplights and stuff like that. And then finally you can get out to a little bit more of a rural area to where you can just go for a long distance and go for it. But yeah.
Yeah, I live in Utah, so and I actually live kind of on the edge of town, so I can get out there pretty fast. There's actually a trail that runs right by the neighborhood I live in, so I can just get on that. And they're doing construction right now, so I can only go about 2 miles before I have to turn around. But once they finish the construction and finish the tunnel under the highway they're building, I can probably ride it all the way out to Provo, which is 10, 15, 20 miles, something like that. So I can go and go, and so I'm looking forward to that. But the other thing is I met a podcaster who does a cycling podcast, and he lives up in Park City, and so I email him every so often and ask him a few questions, and I listen to his podcast, and it's kind of getting me excited. So
yeah. Definitely fun to find people whose interests overlap in some different fields like that. I was out at Rails Camp in Melbourne, Australia last November, and a lot of those Ruby developers are into cycling and do, serious, centuries, 100 miles, stuff like that. Stayed with Marcus Crafter, Gareth Townend, a bunch of those guys out there are into cycling, and maybe they do Ruby programming in their head while they're doing it. I don't know.
Yeah, program their bicycles or something.
Yeah, there's that appeal of some expensive piece of equipment that costs as much as your laptop, and then to go do some exercise at the same time.
Yeah. So I do want to get back on to programming a little bit more. You did mention the conferences. Are there any conferences that you think are kind of the must attends for Ruby or Rails developers?
I missed my first RailsConf this year. Had a trial a couple weeks ago, and so I wasn't at RailsConf. I'd been at all the other ones. Personally, though, I love the smaller conferences, the 100 or 150 people conferences. Went to the first Gotham Ruby conference, was definitely great. So to me, it's like, find me any Ruby conference that's single track, one room, limited number of people. I love that kind of thing. Golden Gate Ruby conference, all those I definitely draw. I want to get out sometime to the European Ruby conference. I think that is actually multiple tracks, but it always sounds like that's just a hoot. Some of the different personalities and stuff that are out there. For me, I love the smaller conferences, especially when, get people that we've never heard or that don't, you're going to start me off on a rant here, but, there's so many people that have written amazing Ruby software that just never, for some reason, we never see these people at conferences. You know, Christian Newkirken, the author of Rack. Rack is gigantic. It's, you know, it's all over Rails. It's, you know, every Ruby web framework uses it. Why isn't he keynoting conferences and stuff like that? And anyway, but if you go to some of these smaller conferences, often you will hear from people that you didn't hear from before, and you'll, you know, get a new perspective find something new.
It makes sense, you know, and it's funny because I went to Mountain West RubyConf this March, and
yeah, that's another good one.
I wound up talking to Miles Forrest and Dan Cubb, and I told Miles this when I talked to him for this podcast. But I was like, man, I was tempted just to find something blunt, smack Dan over the head, drag him in a room, and not let him out for a week until he taught me everything he knew. You know? And yeah, it's guys like that, you know, the guys that are the heads down coders that, you know, they're not so much about talking about what they're doing, but they're doing great stuff. You know, I want to hear from them. I mean, I would give, you know, I would pay good money just to see how his laptop's set up, you know? And see how he works, because, you know, he just does amazing stuff and hard stuff. And, you know, just figure out how he thinks through some of these problems.
Definitely. And even, I mean, I guess you asked about conferences, which I'll also have to mention again, Rails Camp. They basically started, you know, it's basically kind of a bar camp or a foo camp type thing, but it's become a real institution in Australia, and then they've done some others. I think there have been one or two in like Boston, and then a couple in Europe. I think they had one in London, but that's exactly that kind of thing, because you go, there's no plan, no speeches organized, and you just find someone that you want to talk to and work on a project somehow. The other thing is just like create your own experience. I was going to do a project with John Barnett here in Seattle, and it didn't end up happening, but we did get together a half dozen times to just start working on this project, and I learned a ton from just, you know, two or three hours sitting down watching how he writes applications. It was incredible.
Yeah, well, you know, it's you wind up pairing with some of these people, or, you know, even pairing with somebody that's supposedly a quote junior developer. You know, sometimes you pick some cool stuff up from them, and, you know, you're just like, wow. Or somebody that comes over from another language, and, you know, they're thinking about things in a completely different plane from where you're at. And, you know, there's something brilliant that just comes out of that. It's a lot of fun.
Oh, definitely. Or even branch out. I mean, I go to some of the Seattle Mac coding meetups here and met a lot of people who are now pretty good friends, and, you know, that maybe they do a little Ruby, or maybe they know Ruby well, or maybe they do something completely different, and you know, you learn about other languages and approaches as well.
Yeah, it's true. I'd also like to talk to you about your coding. It looks like there are a few things that from your websites you've done, one of which is Gruff. And that's something that I've actually used before. I didn't know that you were responsible for such a thing. But, you know, it's a pretty handy library for making graphs in your Ruby code. And if I remember right, it uses ImageMagick and RMagick on the back end to draw your graphs.
Yeah, it does. And oddly, I hope I'm not giving away secret information here, but I haven't actually used Gruff for like a year or something. Somehow I haven't used it in a while, but yeah, a lot of people still find it useful. And that was actually one of the early things, like when I started using Rails like 5 years ago, a lot of people were just saying, oh, there isn't any good graphing software. And so I thought, well, let's see what I can do and put it together. And it's still one of the biggest traffic, you know, the Google searches that up on my Newbie on Rails blog is for graphing. But I actually, most of the stuff I'm using now is in JavaScript using this thing called Raphael, you know, it just draws it right in the web, in the browser, and you can have a little bit more interaction and stuff. But Gruff is, you know, yeah, people definitely still using it and still works.
I've heard of Raphael. Is there a Ruby wrapper for that, or is it just pretty easy to hammer together in JavaScript?
I don't think it's just JavaScript. I don't think a Ruby wrapper would be a good idea. It's just pure JavaScript, and you they've implemented some graphs. Most of the ones I use, I've implemented just on my own, but yeah, it's just JavaScript. You just do drawings, circles, lines, boxes, you know, all those kinds of things.
Cool. It looks like I was poking around. I also found roughunderbelly.com.
Yeah, that was... What was that? That was... I think it was an initial experiment with Ajax and writing some extra JavaScript and actually using RJS, which at the time seemed like a good idea, but now I don't know if I would recommend that to anybody. But yeah, a little task manager for people to keep track of tasks and kind of give things a point value so you can kind of sort and prioritize what things are going to be more important to do throughout the day. And then that actually, that does use Gruff to then give you a graph so you can see, well, in the last couple of weeks or something, how well did I do?
That's interesting. Do you still do any freelance work at all?
No, I'm fortunately, PeepCode is more than 100% of my time. Well, I guess technically it's not more than 100%, but no, it's been 3.5 years or something like that since I've done consulting.
Oh, interesting. So you just do projects like this on the side as you find the interest and make the time, I guess?
Yeah. The Rough Underbelly, actually, that was, you know, just a to-do list was like, that was like 5 years ago, and I just left it up and running. I haven't even checked. I bet that's still running on like Rails 1.2 or something like that. But yeah, you know, I'm definitely always trying to come up with either interesting projects that can be used to illustrate some different idea for a screencast or just something that I personally would find useful.
Yeah. Now, do you do the design on these yourself or do you have a designer that you bring in to help put these together?
It's all me. Yeah, 100%. The only, well, recently I, for my, for blog.peepco.com, I did hire an illustrator to design one of the headers, and I paid someone to design an icon for this PeepOpen application. But other than that, yeah, it's all me doing the design, doing the coding, which I think has been a really great learning experience. I look at the kind of things that I was designing 10 years ago when I was in college and 5 years ago when I was just starting Rails, and you know, I think I do a lot better now just because I've been hammering away at it and continually practicing it.
So when I'm designing or when I'm building things, my problem is I look at it, I'm like, it's okay, but I know it could be so much better because I have a lot of friends that are professional designers, you know, former coworkers and things, and I know that they could do something that just totally looks amazing. And so I'm always a little timid about releasing things that I've designed myself. You know, is that something that you can get over or is that something that you should be able to get over? Or, you know, are you better off finding an illustrator or a designer to help you with those things?
Well, it depends on a couple things. One is, you know, money. Do you have the resources to pay a designer to do stuff? A good designer costs as much as a good Rails developer. So you're going to be paying $100 or $150 an hour for a really good designer to do something. Of course, there's a whole scale depending on what you want. But so if you have the money, great. Yeah, go for a designer. But if you don't have the money, then maybe that's not even an option. Another thing is just personally, I mean, I think people are too afraid of just trying something because they think that it's going to be a bad result. Well, that means you're starting, you're learning something. I play the double bass. I play jazz. I think right now I'm not very good. I think I'm a pretty horrible jazz bassist, but I go out, I do it every week, and I have a teacher, and I have a group of people that we practice with, and every week I learn something and I get better. So the second thing, you know, would just be motivation. Do you want to get better? It's, you know, it's not, doesn't mean you're going to be a world famous designer, but if you just do something, get out there. And if you can see that if you have the insight to look at something and say, oh, that doesn't look very good. Well, that's fantastic. Now you can critique your own work, and at least you may not know what it should look like, but you know that that's not good. So let's keep refining it until it gets better, which to me is no different than how we write software. I mean, iteration, mm-hmm. You know, Scrum, Agile, all this stuff. Get something out there. Who cares how good it is, or even if it's fully implemented, just get your first shot out there, do another iteration, improve on it, focus on something. And to me, that's how you learn. That's how you write code. That's how you improve. That's how you learn any kind of skill.
It's, you know, it's funny. I think I needed that reminder because, I mean, I went through the same thing with the podcast. It took me 3 months from the time I decided I was going to do a podcast to actually do a podcast to put out my first episode. And yeah, I mean, that was really what it came down to, was I spent 3 months agonizing over, well, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know what I'm doing. You know, and I emailed Greg Pollock and I said, I'm thinking about starting a podcast, and, you know, how do I do it? And he basically said, you just do it, you know, and he gave me a few more pointers than that. But, you know, it was interesting because, you know, finally I just got around to doing it. And then, you know, I got to interview Greg and, you know, just a few things like that. And then it still took me another month to actually put the episodes up on a blog with feed. And, you know, now it seems natural, and you forget that, you know, ultimately what made you successful in the first place was that you tried.
Exactly. And I think we don't share our process while we're learning things. So we do look at people and just think, oh, everyone must just start fully capable of doing this, and, you know, I better not even try if I can't do as well as the experts. But no, they started from scratch, one, you know, square one too.
Yeah, well, and it's funny because, you know, even the mistakes the experts make, or, you know, people who are new at something, either way, I mean, those are just as educational as when they're showing you how to successfully complete something. I just put out the first screencast in a series on teachmetocode.com. I'm just going to build a simple blog. And, you know, I had a cucumber task that I couldn't figure out how to make it pass. And so eventually I just worked around it. And I had one person basically reach out and say, hey, you need to leave all those problems that you run into like that in, so that we know that, you know, we're going to run into the same thing when we do it. And, you know,
exactly.
And it helps us figure out how to get around it too.
Oh, exactly. Because that's, you know, I love open source software, but there are huge numbers of rough edges around things and things that don't quite work right. And that's exactly the kind of thing that we can help each other out with either just our own learning process, or finding, you know, bugs or poor design in the software itself, and how we could improve it.
Yeah, that's very true. Now, there are two things that I typically try and, or I will be typically trying to ask the people that come onto the show. One is one that I usually ask, and the other one is something that I'm going to try and do more of. The first one is, what in your estimation makes a good developer?
Well, I guess, you know, following up what we just said, I think I'm still on that path, definitely to being a good developer, being a better developer. And I think I'm often trying to learn new things that I didn't learn before. So I'm continually putting myself back in that kind of step one seat. So some things that I've observed recently about looking at other people that I respect as good developers is, first, you know, one is just self-analysis of being able to analyze yourself and analyze your own code, critique your own code. Don't feel like you have to defend your code as being personally tied to your own personal worth, but look at your code, look at things that you've done, and find a way that it could have been done better. Find a way that you could even coach yourself to improve things. And then looking at, this could be a multi-hour, multi-day conversation, but another thing I think good developers do is they'll find, let's say, the conventions of how things are often done or what's already built into a framework and how to use that properly versus trying to just build it all themselves from scratch. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of times when I look back at code that I've written that now I say, oh, that's horrible code. Why did I do it that way? It was because I too quickly just tried to dive into the problem and start writing code, and I didn't spend as much time reading the documentation or seeing how that problem may have already been solved in the existing framework and using it that way. So that's something I'm trying to do more now is before I just jump right into coding, try to educate myself a little bit about how other people are doing stuff or how the framework was built.
Yeah, it's true. I really think that that ability to evaluate yourself, and not just that, but the ability to continually learn, and it's not just an ability. It really takes I think a certain level of passion. And I think that's really what brings people to that great developer area. And so they evaluate where they're at, like you said, and find ways to make things better. But at the same time, they recognize that really, at best, you're expert in a couple of areas, and you're intermediate at best in all the rest. And so it's the guys that can go out and figure out how to gain the expertise in those other areas that really seem to be the best developers. And it's not because they're necessarily smarter than other people. It's because they're willing to take the chance and expose themselves to whatever it is that they need to pick up and learn.
And even, this is going to go even more indirect, but looking at experts in other fields of things completely unrelated to coding, what do other experts do? How do they go about solving problems? What does a really good, really good carpenter or a really good project manager or something like that, what kind of things do they do? That often then can either give you practical things to directly implement yourself or just understand how people go about becoming an expert in anything. I feel like recently I've started to notice or had been fortunate to interact with other people who are like really experts in whatever they do. It doesn't mean they're highly paid. It doesn't mean they own their own business or sold something for, millions of dollars. It's that they not only do a profession, but they love doing it. They continually try to improve, and you can just tell that, wow, I'm interacting with somebody who is really an expert. And to me, that's inspiring, because then even though maybe that specific field isn't something that I want to do, it inspires me to come back and say, okay, I want to be that kind of a individual in relation to computer programming, video editing, teaching, all the kinds of things I do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, the other question that I'm trying to ask more people is, what resources do you recommend for new developers? And then I'm going to ask you in a minute what resources you recommend for the more intermediate or advanced developers.
Well, just get it out of the way. Of course, we'll say PeepCode screencasts. That's definitely what I try to provide for a variety of developers. It feels like, I'll direct them to you as well. I mean, there are all kinds of great free and paid screencasts out there for about Ruby, and that's a way that I enjoy learning on any kind of topic, being able to sit down and watch a video and understand something. It's unfortunate that a lot of blogging, I think, especially among Ruby developers, has kind of fizzled out over the last couple of years. I feel like 4 or 5 years ago, it was like everybody was starting a blog where they were writing, you know, full articles, really technical, including code, you know, helping people to learn this different stuff. And unfortunately, a lot of those blog posts that are still out there are not as relevant anymore. The APIs have changed or things like that. And it seems like people are writing those kinds of things a lot less. But I think, you know, finding the good blogs that are still out there is a great way. John Neunemaker is always writing good articles. Bunch of different things out there. Peter Cooper, I think, is coming out with a news type thing. I don't know if supposedly oriented at coders, but
it's already out. I just signed up for it today. It's called coder.io.
Okay.
And it's really nice.
And that might be more like news instead of specific coding tips, but
yeah.
The other thing, though, is I think I told people, you know, this is the way I answered this question, you know, a number of years ago, and I still say it, but go read through all the Rails documentation. I mean, that's how I learned Rails at the beginning. Was just, I sat, you know, for a couple days, I just read through every method, every class. What description do they have of, you know, what this method does? I didn't necessarily remember all of it, but at least I knew it was there in the back of my head somehow. And a lot of times they will have useful examples or little code snippets or things like that. And I think that's a great place to start, even though it's a huge amount of information.
You know, that's so true. I was reading the Rails, Active Record Base. I was reading through the code and the comments, and I think I got as much out of the code as the comments, both in the sense of, well, gee, I didn't know you could do that, and, oh, well, that's an undocumented feature that I could exploit in this way or that way, which makes Rails powerful. And then also, you know, just the general, oh, well, you can do that with Ruby, and how are they doing that, and what exactly does it do?
Yeah, I would not recommend that for new developers. I know the Rails 3 code is a lot cleaner and more respectable than the previous versions, but I'd say stick to the pros documentation. But for advanced developers, yes, definitely. Advanced developers, go in there and read the code.
Yeah. Well, the comments are pretty easy to understand, and the Rails guides, guides.rails.com, are excellent.
Yeah, they've done a great job on those, and they look beautiful.
Yeah, in fact, if you're an expert and you want to write one, you go into the Lighthouse ticket area for Rails, and they have a section for Rails guides, and they actually commission those. They put up a request for a particular guide, and then if you want to do it, you get like $50 in free hosting and a few other goodies for writing the Rails guides. In other words, they have sponsors for the guides. And I think that really just demonstrates how committed the Rails team is to having good documentation out there and making it as easy as possible for people to get in and use Rails and make the most of it.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, on the other hand, they kind of have to be because it's changing all the time. But the Rails guides are definitely good.
Yep. Well, it looks like we're coming right up on an hour, so I'm going to let you go. But thank you so much for coming onto the podcast. I just want to remind everybody, if you want to find out what Jeffrey here is up to, you can go to jeffreygrossenbach.com. You can also go to peakcode.com. And as he pointed out, it's a great resource for both new and intermediate developers trying to learn how to program in Rails. They've got some iPhone and Objective-C stuff. I mean, just some great, great content. And they have some PDF books, though not as many as the screencasts, but I think the screencasts are the real meat anyway. Just keep up. Go ahead and read the blog. I think I think the blog really offers some interesting insights into programming, and I think you'll come to appreciate the perspective in those as I have. Is there anywhere else that people can follow up on what you're up to? I guess on Twitter, twitter.com/topfunky.
Yeah, those are the main sources.
All right. Well, you know, thanks again, and go check out the Ruby on Rails podcast. How often do you put those out?
You know, I'm trying to hit monthly now. My last one was with Dan Cederholm and Rich Thornett, who have a new design site that's becoming pretty popular, and it's written in Rails. It's called Dribbble.
I need to go check that out. But it sounded really cool on the podcast.
Well, great. Well, thanks a lot. It was great to chat with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe we'll have to do it again sometime.
Sounds good.
All right. Well, I'll have this up probably in about 2 weeks. I do every other podcast as an interview. And the one I put out on Tuesday was an interview. So I guess a week and a half. So it'll be like the 6th of July.
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks again.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Bye.
All right. Well, I'd like to thank Jeffrey for coming onto the podcast. And I would encourage you to go check out the stuff that he's got at peepcode.com. Also, just a reminder that you can leave feedback on the podcast by going to or by emailing Chuck at teachmetocode.com or by calling 801-753-8279. And I'd also like to encourage you to go check out our sponsor, New Relic, at www.newrelic.com. Thanks.